This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. On August 28, 1963, hundreds of thousands of people gathered here in Washington to demand passage of the Civil Rights Act and ask America to redeem the promise of equality. It would be the biggest political demonstration ever staged in the United States up to that time, and probably the most persuasive ever. 40 years later, it's part of our national narrative. On this hour of Talk of the Nation, we want to retrace the course of that historic day. If you made it to the march or if it affected your life, we want to hear your story. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. For many who did make it to the march, the day began long before the speeches and the entertainers. Demonstrators converging on the Mall traveled for days or even weeks to get there. At dawn, across the East Coast and the Midwest, buses and trains were rolling towards Washington, D.C. Coolie Vic Kilimanjaro rode the bus from North Carolina that day. In the summer of 1963, she was a young librarian and NAACP member in Greensboro, North Carolina. Today, she joins us from the offices of the Carolina Peacemaker, a black community newspaper she and her husband founded in Greensboro a few years after participating in the march. And good of you to be with us on Talk of the Nation.
Hello.
Hello. I understand you set off for the march very early that morning in North Carolina. Tell us about that trip.
Okay. It was just 3 days before August the 28th in 1963, and my husband and I were still looking for a babysitter. And 2 days before the march and before the departure to Washington, we finally found a babysitter because I was determined to go to this march on Washington. The buses left Greensboro shortly after midnight and arrived in Washington, I would guess, around 7:30 a.m.
Now, it was already light by that time. What could you see?
Oh, we could see the buses everywhere. The trip was interesting and exciting, and upon arrival, there were hundreds of buses and people, black, white, labor leaders, religious leaders, civil rights leaders, just covered the Washington Mall. More people than I've ever seen in my life.
Once you started seeing all those other buses, did you start to realize that this was going to be bigger than even maybe you'd thought?
I certainly did. And we met people there from other states that we had met in previous occasions, and people whom we knew in the past. And there were entertainers at different locations on the mall.
Any you remember in particular?
Any entertainers?
Yeah.
Oh, yes. There was Sidney Poitier, and we stopped. I think my husband and I first stopped with a group of people to listen to Peter, Paul, and Mary while they sang peace songs. Marian Anderson was there, and, of course, she was one of the participants in the program that afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
But there were a number of different people singing at different positions throughout the mall.
Why was it so important for you to be there that day?
It was important because I felt that this was a historic event and that I had heard Martin Luther King before, and I knew that this was going to be an exciting time because they had estimated and anticipated the number of people that might be at this march. Of course, at first I was a little leery because some people were afraid and they were saying what's going to happen and that sort of thing. I said, well, whatever happens will happen, and we're still struggling for our rights, so I'm going to go.
As we mentioned, you helped found a black newspaper in North Carolina just a few years after that. What part did the March on Washington play in that decision?
Well, we took a quote from Dr. King's speech, and this was a speech that he made at Bennett College back in 1958, and that was the first time that I've ever heard him speak in person. And we used his quote, and Americans must learn to live together as brothers, lest we all die together as fools. And we use that as a slogan on our newspaper today, and it's on the front of our building. And it was a moving speech that he made, and of course at that time he was talking about peace, and he talked to my husband and said, well, you need to join up with me and go on some of these big marches and that sort of thing. But we decided to stay here and to to do our newspaper, and our newspaper was founded a few years, 1967, which was a number of years later.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today.
Okay, you're welcome.
Coolie Vic Kilimanjaro runs with her husband the Carolina Peacemaker, a weekly newspaper in Greensboro, North Carolina, and she joined us from the newspaper's offices. That day of August in August 1963 was brutally hot and muggy. A few hours after dawn, the sky would be white and glaring. Even though the march took place on a Wednesday, downtown Washington, D.C. was profoundly quiet. The city braced for the chaos that some predicted. Joining us now to take us through the unfolding day is Patrick Henry Bass, the author of Like a Mighty Stream, The March on Washington. He joins us from our bureau in New York, and thank you very much for being with us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Now, this march came together over the course of about 2 months, but as you remind us in your book, it was also the product of 100 years since Abraham Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation in 1863.
That's correct. There were actually two previous marches on Washington. The first was in 1941, organized by A. Philip Randolph and Bayard Rustin, and they would also organize a 1957 march and the 1963 march. The 1941 march was to call attention to discrimination in defense industry hiring. The march was set for July 1st, 1941. A. Philip Randolph and Bayard Rustin got together about 100,000 African Americans from across the country who were willing to come to Washington to protest this discrimination in the defense industry. Franklin Delano Roosevelt was pretty nervous about this, and so when he found himself in trouble with the Negro community in terms of this defense industry hiring, he did what he always did when it came to the Black community. He called Eleanor and asked her to help him out. So Eleanor Roosevelt played a vital role in linking A. Philip Randolph and President Roosevelt together, and President Roosevelt issued an executive order that banned discrimination in defense industry hiring. In 1957, May 17th, there was another march on Washington that was considered a monumental flop. Mm-hmm. It was called a pilgrimage for prayer, and it didn't have a mission, really. It was one of the few missteps from Bayard Rustin. But what it did do, it introduced the nation to Dr. King. It was the first time that he had addressed a national audience. So many people were pretty skeptical about the 1963 march because the 1957 march had underwhelming numbers and the 1941 march was called off.
What was the organizing principle in 1963? Why was it deemed necessary to pull together this massive demonstration that summer?
Well, it was an interracial, interfaith movement, and it was the official title of the March on Washington is the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. So mm-hmm. What the organizers, they learned from their mistakes. They learned that this had to be an inclusive march. At first, there were 6 African-American leaders from the NAACP, the Urban League, the Congress of Racial Equality, and other organizations, but they realized that they had to open up the tent a little bit larger, so they included members of the Jewish faith from the Catholic League, from Labor. Walter Ruther from the AFL-CIO played a tremendous role in this particular march, the 1963 march. So they wanted to envelop all people, and they wanted to have a demonstration that down in Washington, D.C. to show that this was not a Black issue. When we think about segregation, we of course think about the deep pockets of the South, but segregation existed in the Northeast. It existed in the Midwest. When I was doing research on the book, I wanted to look at what some of the laws were, and they're quite disturbing because they're so serpentine and so Byzantine, and they affect so many levels of our lives. For instance, African Americans could not try on clothing in department stores. If we purchased the clothing, we couldn't return it because our hands had already touched it. Schools for the blind were segregated. And these were public situations. I'm not talking about private situations. Public schools for the blind were separate. I mean, what the March on Washington was called for was to end that, you know, right then, right there, if possible.
We're speaking with Patrick Henry Bass. His newly published book is Like a Mighty Stream, The March on Washington, August 28th, 1963. If you'd like to join our conversation, the phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. And let's talk to Larry, who is with us from St. Paul, Minnesota.
Well, I was young conscientious objector to war at that time, and I was working in Des Moines, Iowa, doing alternative service to the draft. I organized a busload of mostly poor people from the NAACP and the Congress of Racial Equality. The busload went to Washington for the march, and the two groups hadn't been getting along real well, but I was able to get them to co-sponsor the bus ride. And we stayed overnight in an African-American Baptist church. I remember sleeping on the floor Friday night. And three African-American women and I rented a cab, and I sat next to the driver, and we went sightseeing on Friday night. And I was fascinated by the limousines of government officials going home from work, and I saw the long fluorescent light tubes over the back seat, and one limo pulled up beside us at a stop sign, stop light, and I looked over, and it was one of the Kennedys, and he was about 4 feet from me, and I shouted, I was beside myself with exuberance, and I shouted, "Teddy Kennedy," and he looked up, and it wasn't Teddy at all, it was Bobby. And he said, "Well, hello there." And so that's how I met Bobby Kennedy the night before the march, you know, really by accident. I got his name all wrong in my excitement. So.
Well, of course, at the time, Attorney General of the United States.
Yeah, he was. Yeah. And then on the day of the march, I was on my feet all day. I took these, some of the women, we walked through the halls of Congress, and Barry Goldwater came along, and I leaned over to them. I said, "Do you recognize him?" And I don't think they did. And I told him, he gave us a big scowl. He didn't like being talked about in that way. And it was rude of me, I guess, to point him out when he was so close. But and then on the day at the march, I worked my way up to the snow fence in front of the speakers during the music portion. And for the first and only time in my life, I felt claustrophobic because these hundreds of thousands of people were pressing me against the fence. And I worked my way back to get out of the thick of the crowd. And by the time Dr. King spoke, I was way at the back of the reflecting pool by myself. I was just nearly exhausted from walking for 8 or 9 hours.
Yeah. Quick question, Larry. Yeah. What did it sound like? How was the sound system that day?
Well, it was. I think it was pretty fair. I had a little pocket transistor radio. Transistors were pretty new then. And I may have listened to it partly on that, but I remember being so tired, and I'd heard him speak before, and it didn't strike me as a particularly great speech. So I, looking back, it's like being at Gettysburg and missing the significance of the talk, you know.
Fatigue does funny things.
Yeah, it really did.
Thanks very much for the remembrance, Larry.
Sure.
Appreciate the phone call.
Glad to.
We just have a little time left in this section, Patrick Henry Bass, but coalition politics, no easier then than it is now.
I'm speechless about the thoughts on the speech, but that's okay. you were asking me about the organization, probably the eve before the March on Washington. It was quite chaotic. It was a mess, actually. You had Malcolm X, who was threatening a press conference. He was calling it the farce on Washington. At any moment, he was going to do issue a statement at the Statler Hilton, and all the civil rights leaders were trying to, you know, shut him up. George Lincoln Rockwell of the Nazi Party wanted to hold a press conference. No one knew where they were staying. No one knew how many people were actually coming. I was pleased to hear Mrs. Kilimanjaro talk about the estimation of the number of people who were coming, because people thought it was going to be actually low. And Washington shut down. I mean, there was nothing open because people were very much offended. The Washingtonians, they were thinking that there was an invasion of their town, if you will.
Yep, they even closed the liquor stores for fear that there would be drinking and rioting, which, of course, offended a lot of people. We're celebrating the 40th anniversary of the March on Washington. Coming up after the break, how the march electrified other civil rights movements. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're revisiting that memorable day 40 years ago when the National Mall in Washington, D.C. rang with the voices of 250,000 marchers there to urge the passage of the Civil Rights Act. And above that noisy but peaceful crowd rose the speeches that have gone down in history. To view a copy of the day's official program listing all of the speakers and performers, you can go to our website at www.npr.org. One of the day's first speakers was then 23-year-old John Lewis, head of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee.
We do not want to go to jail, but we will go to jail if this is the price we must pay for love, brotherhood, and true peace. I appeal to all of you to get in this great revolution that is sweeping this nation. Get in and stay in the streets of every city, every village and hamlet of this nation until true freedom come, until the revolution of 1776 is complete. We must get in this revolution and complete the revolution. For in the Delta of Mississippi, in Southwest Georgia, in the Black Belt of Alabama, in Harlem, in Chicago, Detroit, Philadelphia, and all over this nation, the black masses are on the march for jobs and freedom.
Joining us now is Raul Izaguirre, who attended the march in 1963 while he was a college student at Georgetown University. He helped out manning a first aid station. Today he's president of the National Council of La Raza, the nation's largest Latino advocacy organization. He joins us now by phone from Miami in Florida. And thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure, Neil.
You were living in Washington at that time as a student. How different was the city on that particular day?
Well, it was a sleepy southern city. It didn't have the kind of momentum and zest that it has today, and it was a slower time.
I think President Kennedy was famous for remarking that Washington, D.C. in those days was a city that combined southern efficiency and northern charm.
That's about right.
It was very hot at the march. Did you have a lot of people coming to that first aid booth you were working at?
We did indeed. There was a lot of dehydration, heat stroke. A lot of people were passing out. Unfortunately, we were understaffed and undermanned and had very few resources, but we managed.
Did things work smoothly behind the scenes? It was the logistics, was it all well supported?
Well, I wasn't part of that. I was just at the periphery of things. I was more a spectator than a participant. I was just carrying people in and out, but I stopped long enough to listen to Martin Luther King's speech, and I was transformed by his eloquence.
Now, you were already active in the Latino rights movement before the march, but I wonder if the events of that day and maybe that speech changed your approach.
It did indeed. I used a lot of the phraseology, a lot of the thinking, and I certainly was inspired by his thoughts. Although the focus was on the African-American community at that time, I think his thoughts, his sense of justice resonated with us who had perhaps a broader sense of inclusion and who wanted Latinos and Native Americans and other minorities to be an integral part of a civil rights movement.
We use the word, you know, sometimes from that day of electrification. Besides yourself, do you know of other people who left that day and became organizers?
Well, I don't know any. I can't give you specifics, but I know from time to time I met people at different events who were also at that wonderful historic moment, and they were equally inspired. I know that it moved me to have a greater sense of commitment. It moved me to want to work in Mississippi as well as in the Southwest, and I had a fair amount of involvement in the civil rights movement in the Southeast.
Now, as I understand it, you were, as we mentioned, working as a first aid worker. At the moment that Dr. King stepped up to speak, you were helping somebody. Tell us what happened.
Well, I was working with somebody else, and we were carrying a lady in a stretcher, and I was near the Lincoln Memorial, near the podium, when Martin Luther King began his speech. And the moment he got there, and the majesty of his voice so impressed me, and I just knew instinctively that this was going to be a great speech. And you have to remember that although he is famous now, he wasn't quite as famous then as he is now. He wasn't the clear leader of the civil rights movement. He had a lot of other competitors for that title in 1963, but I was just so impressed with his voice, and then later on with the content of his speech, that I asked the lady if she minded if I put her down while I listened to the speech, and she was accommodating. I think she wanted to listen to the speech herself. So, fortunately, the patient survived.
Yeah, just put a little pressure on that vein; it'll stop the bleeding.
Precisely. You know, we'll get around to you eventually.
Thanks very much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Raul Izaguirre is the president of the National Council of La Raza, and he joined us on the phone from Miami in Florida. Our guest throughout this hour is Patrick Henry Bass. He's the author of Like a Mighty Stream. He's with us from our bureau in New York. And let's get another phone call. And joining us on the line is Angela, who's in Portland, Oregon.
Hi.
Hi.
I was in high school at the time, and my girlfriend and I had signed up to go to the march and went to some dark parking lot in the middle of the night and saw there were many buses and got on our bus and went down to Washington. And when we got down there, we realized that it was a much bigger thing than we had imagined. And I had played hooky from school that day. I was a senior in high school. And
so you were what, 16, 17?
I was 17.
Yeah.
And I told my father I was staying at Robin's house, my friend. And so when we got down there...
And I assume Robin told her parents she was staying over at your house.
Exactly right. Yeah, we did that all the time. But when we got down there and saw all the press coverage and saw how big this thing was, I remember being worried that my father would see me on the news and that I'd be in a load of trouble when I got back to New York. Of course, that didn't happen. But we were just absolutely blown away at the magnitude of this event. And we got up close. We heard Dr. King speak. We were part of this movement in the crowd that just was totally overwhelmed by his words and his tone. It was a wonderful, pivotal moment in my life.
Hmm. Thanks very much, Angela.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Patrick Henry Bass, you know, we think of protests and demonstrations as a way to criticize the government or its policies, but, you know, we have to remember that this one was a way to encourage the government to do something.
Absolutely. When we often think about the civil rights movement, we think about the tragedies, but this was a triumphant moment for not just the civil rights movement, but our nation. It was meant to nudge that civil rights bill along. And in the book, there's a section where Roy Wilkins, who was the leader of the African-American community at that time, he was the executive director of the NAACP, he has a fiery speech that he reads to Congress about his route going from Virginia to Mississippi and all of the challenges that he and his family would face just trying to get an ice cream cone or to go to the bathroom.
Hmm. The Kennedy administration, as Patrick Henry Bass mentioned, was watching the march with great anticipation because a great deal was at stake for them, no less than the passage of landmark legislation, the Civil Rights Act. Lee White was with President Kennedy in the Oval Office watching the march on television. Mr. White served as assistant counsel to President Kennedy from 1961 to 1963. He currently practices law here in Washington. He joins us now by phone from Omaha, Nebraska, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Glad to be with you.
Set the scene for us, if you will. Who else was there with you in the Oval Office that day?
Well, as best I remember, it was a very small group. I know that Evelyn Lincoln, the president's secretary, was there. And by the way, that set had to be brought in for TV. It was not a part of the usual furniture in the president's Oval Office, Kennedy's Oval Office. President Johnson had TVs all over the joint, but this was sort of novel, and used it, for example, on NASA launches. But this was something special, and there were three or four people there. I don't remember who precisely, but everybody's eyes were glued to that TV set. And, of course, we would get occasional reports from the Attorney General, because it was really the Justice Department that was the center of the operation from the federal government's point of view. It was not a federal government undertaking. It was the group itself that had done it, and it was up to the United States government to respond as best it could. And you were right. There was apprehension that there could be some uncomfortable times, some potential violence, and everybody was nervous. 40 years ago, the District of Columbia Police Department were nowhere near as sophisticated as they are today, and we didn't have the experience. And when the numbers were piling up and we heard about tens of thousands and pretty soon hundreds of thousands, there was some real nervousness. The way Bobby Kennedy ran things, he would pick somebody from his own operation, in this case, an assistant attorney general by the name of John Douglas. John Douglas was in charge of the civil division, but he also happened to be the son of the late, great, and distinguished senator from Illinois, Paul Douglas.
Mm-hmm.
But here he is. He's just a good old lawyer, and Bobby puts him in charge of logistics. You know, you have to have an awful lot of portable toilets for a lot of hundreds of thousands of people. And where do they eat, and where does the trash go? And what about if there is bad weather, and what about if there's it was hot, but it wasn't. There were no thunderstorms. In other words, it was a tense time, and as we stood there watching it and getting reports that it seemed to be going okay, we were watching all the speakers, and they were all terrific.
Now, President Kennedy was no mean speechmaker himself. I wondered what he thought as he listened to Martin Luther King's famous speech.
Well, it's been a while, but my recollection is that he had something to say like, holy smoke. You know, he was really taken by it, like everybody else. As one of your speakers said, at that time, Reverend King was one of the group. It was a speech that pulled him out of that group and made him the absolute maximum leader that he was. And it was the cadence, the message, the delivery, everything was just right, and it was a blockbuster. And as all have noted, it's going to be one of the great speeches of all time.
Now, the president issued a response to the day's events, and I understand you actually wrote the statement. We have a copy of it on our website if people want to take a look at it. What was the most important thing you wanted to convey?
Well, basically, it was to recognize that the purpose of the march, which was to secure freedom and jobs, was something that the administration was totally sympathetic for. It had already submitted to Congress the Civil Rights Act, became the Civil Rights Act of 1964. At that time, it was not moving as rapidly, and there was at least some concern that a big demonstration of the sort that did occur could even have a counterproductive effect on Congress. Don't forget it. In those days, most of the committee chairmen were Southerners, and the idea that they were being pressured was a little bit dicey. We didn't know how. Nobody knew how that was going to go. As it is, it went nicely. And when things go nicely, we all like to say, "Well, we did that okay." When it doesn't go nicely, President Kennedy had a line like that. He said, failure is an orphan, and success has 1,000 fathers. And in this case, the success of it was so remarkable. It was a significant, nothing like it has happened since in terms of the numbers and the significance and the impact that it had. It was truly a remarkable day. And I will tell you, at the end of that day, there were an awful lot of sighs of relief that it had gone as smoothly as it had. The version I'm giving of you is unfortunately a little bit negative because we were so anxious that it go smoothly. And when it did, everybody was absolutely thrilled and delighted.
Well, Lee White, thanks very much for telling us about it.
Glad to do it.
Lee White was assistant counsel to President Kennedy, and with him in the Oval Office 40 years ago today, he joined us by phone from Omaha, Nebraska. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller in, and joining us on the line is AC, who's in Washington, D.C.
Hello, yes.
Hi, you're on the air.
I was in the military during that period, here stationed at the Navy station, and it was about 20, 25 blacks and about 10 whites, military people who were very upset with the depiction of King as leading a riot and all sorts of other, characterizations of King in a negative fashion. So we decided that we were going to go to the march irrespective of what the command said. The command had put out a memorandum that said that no military personnel would be able to attend the march, we fired off a letter to the NAACP and to the AFRO indicating this question, and a order came down, I believe, from McNamara and the president.
And McNamara, that, then the Secretary of Defense.
Yeah. They said that the military personnel could attend the march as long as they did not wear uniform. And, of course, following that, we were brought before the commanding officer of the base and read the riot act in terms of we should not engage in any activity that and we should not wear uniform. So we did attend. It was about 30 or 35 military persons who then left and went to the march.
Well, Patrick Henry Bass, I understand that there were, you know, the march also provided its own marshals, black firemen and policemen from various places around the country.
Yes, the Urban League and the NAACP feared that they would not have the protection that they hoped that they would have. So they took matters into their own hands. And a lot of, as you said, firemen and police officers and park rangers, you know, came down and, you know, did their part that day. I want to just say that this really, you know, research in the march, it really was, it wasn't festive. It wasn't a picnic, but it was much lighter than I'm hearing. I mean, there were a lot of things that people who attended would not have known were happening backstage, but it all worked out, you know, quite well. Marian Anderson was supposed to lead off the march by singing the national anthem. She got so caught up in the crowd. That's probably where Miss Kilimanjaro saw her, because she was supposed to be on stage singing. But they plucked this woman, Camilla Williams, from Danville, Virginia, to sing the national anthem. And it was sort of like 42nd Street, where the diva breaks her ankle and the ingenue goes on. You know, things like that were happening all throughout the day. James Baldwin was going up to speak. Then someone yanked him off and said, "No, you're not." And it was all cool. One of the speakers who people don't recognize is Walter Reuther of the AFL-CIO. At that time, CBS owned daytime television. They had As the World Turns and The Edge of Night. And I'm thinking, if The Edge of Night was canceled for anything and my grandmother would appreciate it, it would be the March on Washington. But Walter Reuther's speech really echoed throughout Harlem barbershops and Oakland. I mean, people talk about that speech second to Dr. King's speech, and even it even surpassed in many ways Lewis's speech.
We're going to hear a clip from the Walter Reuther speech when we come back after a short break. We'll also have more with Patrick Henry Bass, the author of Like a Mighty Stream, as we continue to discuss the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. If you'd like to join our conversation, the phone number, as usual, is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email address is TOTN@NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tomorrow, join Ira Flatow on the next Science Friday for a look at long-term blindness and how it affects the visual system. Plus, a molecule in red wine extends the lifespan of yeast. Will that finding hold true in humans? That's tomorrow on Science Friday. And here are some of the stories we're following today here at NPR News. North Korea is threatening to formally declare its possession of nuclear weapons and carry out a nuclear weapons test. The North Korean deputy foreign minister made the threat today at the multilateral security talks in Beijing. Also, the Bush administration is preparing to ask Congress for a huge increase in funding, as much as $3 billion in supplemental spending for the reconstruction of Iraq. More details on those stories later today on All Things Considered. Here on Talk of the Nation, we're celebrating the 40th anniversary of the March on Washington. Though the march was focused on encouraging Congress to pass the Civil Rights Act, labor unions took an active role in this fight. Among the speakers that day was the legendary labor leader, Walter Reuther.
Now, one of the problems is what I call that there is too much high-octane hypocrisy in America. There is a lot of noble talk about brotherhood, and then some Americans drop the brother and keep the hood. To me, the civil rights question is a moral question, which transcends partisan politics. And this rally today should be the first step in a total effort to mobilize the moral conscience of America and to ask the people in Congress of both parties to rise above their partisan differences and enact civil rights legislation now.
Walter Reuther speaking 40 years ago today in Washington. For those of us who did not attend the march, it's almost impossible to imagine it in color, given how deeply it's become identified with the elegant black and white images of the day. March organizers handed out nearly 1,900 special press passes for journalists. Photographers snapped pictures of the crowd from every angle, including from the air. One of those watching the day from behind a camera lens was Bob Adelman, who volunteered to document the march for several civil rights groups. 40 years later, his pictures of the Reverend King at the podium are among the defining images of the event. Bob Adelman joins us now from Courtney in British Columbia, where he's on vacation. It's good of you to break away and be with us today.
Oh, hi.
Tell us about taking those pictures. Where were you?
Well, I originally was with the crowd. I'd come with a lot of the protesters, the young people who were intent upon having a real revolution, and I wanted to catch their spirit and enthusiasm. And slowly, after I kind of documented what they were doing, I moved up toward the podium. And I sort of had just inserted myself there because there wasn't anybody else around. And I was actually right next to Dr. King when he spoke. And, of course, he was my hero. And this was, you know, probably the greatest speech you know, delivered certainly in the second half of the 20th century, and it was, you just were overwhelmed, but of course I was there to take pictures, and Dr. King was a little hard to photograph because he had a round, soft face, and of course in his character was very saintly, and his devotion to his ideals were hard to register on his face, but when he spoke and in his action, you could catch some of that, and I was fortunate to catch him from the side. I think most people's images of him are from the front, and
well, you got
him at that moment when he's saying "Free at last, free at last."
And that picture titled "Free at Last" is certainly one of your better-known photographs. And what was the moment like when you took that picture?
Well, it was very thrilling. You know, at first they'd heard so many talks. At first, people, they were listening. But then, when he really got into, this great Southern Baptist kind of rhythmic talk, the crowd got with it, and the sense of his words was just going over the crowd, and the crowd was just slowly responding, and the roars got more and more as he spoke. It was one of the very great moments of my life, probably the greatest moment of his life. It was just thrilling.
Thanks very much for being with us today, especially for
yes.
breaking away from your vacation.
Sure.
Bob Adelman is a celebrated photographer, co-author of the book King, the photobiography of Martin Luther King, Jr. He joined us from Courtney in British Columbia. his photograph, Free at Last, and some of your memories on the March on Washington. You can see those on our website at www.npr.org. And wanted to read this email that we got from Bob Hitchcock. I was 13 in 1963, he writes. Our pastor was from Lynchburg, Tennessee, Virginia, led about 25 members of the church from near DuPont Circle to the mall. I, with two friends of about the same age, carried the purple banners of the Church of the Savior. It seemed a small event as we began. As we marched, small groups filtered into the main routes, as did we. When we came in view of the mall, everything changed, and the scope of the movement became apparent to all. The entire area was blanketed with Americans of like mind. What a feeling of solidarity. It was hot, and I sought shade in the trees nearest the monument on the left side as you look at it, and I always look to that spot when I see photos of the event. That march was a turning point in my life where I learned to stand up for what's right and to question conventional wisdom as put forth by those in authority. And let's get more of your calls. Patrick Henry Bass is still with us, and joining us now on the line, who's James, who's with us from Bloomfield Hills in Michigan.
Good afternoon. I was 16 at the time, and it was a life-changing event for me. I was too young to really pay attention to the other speakers, but I remember Dr. King's words, and they were electrifying. The whole crowd was electrified, and I think everyone there changed their lives.
How did it change yours in particular?
Well, I think it gave me a larger vision of myself as a young black man, and it, like many of the other callers, you knew at that moment that this movement was going to change the world.
Patrick Henry Bass is still with us from our bureau in New York, Again, that moment was transcendental, a march that started to demand the passage of the Civil Rights Act and has took on so much more.
Right. Dr. King's speech was actually previewed in Detroit at a labor rally. And he tailored it up until the moment of, stepping out on the podium to wow the crowd. I want to talk for just a second about Mahalia Jackson, because the crowd has started to get a little tired. They had been there, for a few hours. And she wowed them with I've Been Buked and I've Been Scorned and Lord Stand By Me. So she really woke the crowd up. She went on, and then Jaheim Prinz went on, and then Dr. King went on. So many people had heard of the I Have a Dream speech in Detroit. And just before Dr. King stepped up to the podium, Mahalia Jackson leaned in and said to him, "Don't forget to tell him about the dream, Martin." Now, I don't know what that was about. I don't know whether he was going to forget to say, I don't know. But maybe she knew something he didn't know, or we don't know. But she certainly kept everybody alert and alive.
Well, James, thank you very much for the phone call. We appreciate it.
I had a double honor. I was also fortunate enough to have marched with Dr. King in Detroit and have actually shook his hand.
In that march in Detroit. Yeah, we heard yesterday from one of the people who was involved in organizing that event at Cobo Hall in Detroit. Thanks very much for being with us, James.
Thank you.
And Patrick Henry Bass, we appreciate your time today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Patrick Henry Bass is the author of the book Like a Mighty Stream, The March on Washington. He was with us from our bureau in New York, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation, coming to you from NPR News. While we know that an estimated 250,000 people actually attended the March on Washington that day, it's impossible to know how many millions more watched it on television. It was broadcast around the world using the new technology of the satellite Telstar. We do know that Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and Chicago Tribune syndicated columnist Clarence Page was glued to his television screen watching history unfold. Clarence Page joins us now here in Studio 3A, and it's very good of you to be with us today.
Thanks, Neil. Great to be here.
Forgive the impertinence of the question, but how old were you on August 28th, 1963?
It pains me to acknowledge I was 16. So that's 40 years ago. I'm 56 now, but the 40 years has gone by fast.
I assume you were in high school at the time in Middletown, Ohio?
That's right. Right between Cincinnati and Dayton there, a lovely steel town of about 40,000. They don't make as much steel as they used to.
No, I don't think anywhere in that part of Ohio.
You got it.
Were you interested in politics at the time?
Yeah, and certainly in civil rights, you couldn't be an African American without. You know, I sound like an old geezer, but I have to point out a couple things. You know, you're right about the coverage, and remember, it was live on three networks. That was a big deal, Neil. I don't know what other demonstration I can recall that's been live on all the networks, and there were only three networks then, and we watched it all in black and white. And for black folks, seeing Dr. King's speech was not something new. You know, in those days, any black person on TV, you'd rush to the screen to see who it was, Harry Belafonte, Nat King Cole, with Diane Carroll, whoever. And you'd also call up your friends and relatives. Well, whenever Dr. King was on, or remember, this is right after a summer, a couple of years now, of demonstrations in Birmingham, police dogs, fire hoses.
Yeah.
You had the student sit-ins in North Carolina. I could go on and on. These were tense times. It was also a very hot day, and there had been some civil unrest in cities in the north already, minor compared to what would come later, as you know.
Sure.
But these were very tense times. But black folks, seeing King, there was nothing new to us. Now I talk to Peter Jennings and other prominent white folks, and that was the first time they'd seen him. And, I mean, Peter was a young newsman then, you know, now ABC anchor and various other folks. And it occurs to me now that this was a very big deal in black life. It was just becoming a big deal in white life in America.
Hmm. As you listened, which of the speeches captivated you the most?
Well, you know, I was captivated by a number of things. You just played Walter Reuther there, an excerpt. And I remember I was impressed whenever any white person got up to the podium to speak. And Reuther, of course, longtime labor organizer, was terrific and dynamic. I remember Peter, Paul, and Mary getting up and singing a few years later. I would have the opportunity to interview them as a college student at Ohio University, sadly enough, on the night after Dr. King was shot. While seeing Marlon Brando up there on the stage. But also, there were so many prominent black folks, James Baldwin, of course, and numerous other people. But, you know, Dr. King was the last act of the day. They were kept to 5 minutes, I would later learn. And Dr. King, and this is just an addenda to what was just discussed a little earlier in the program. You know, the I Have a Dream segment was not in his prepared remarks. This is what's interesting here, because there was about 10 minutes of prepared speech, and he went on. He was just getting on a roll, and that was where it was so important that he had already done those riffs, the I Have a Dream line in Detroit and several other cities as well. Mm-hmm. And watch the film now, Neil, and you'll see his eyes leave the text at that point, and he is completely ad-libbing, so to speak, or, you know, extemporaneous, but he's already, of course, rehearsed it and worked it over in his mind and with earlier crowds. And it's been compared to an oratorical jazz riff, I mean, because he is playing with the crowd and with that home audience. And believe me, it had a riveting impact across the nation.
We've talked about the speech's electrifying effect on any number of people. What about you?
Well, it was a moment where I felt that it wasn't just Dr. King, but it was Black America on stage now, making its case before the country. You know, I at that point was in high school, and there were, you know, amusement parks that had been closed to colored people, and we were colored in those days. We're just beginning to open up, and this is in Ohio. This is in the North. Stores that had not welcomed us, restaurants where we had to brown bag it and couldn't sit down and eat, hotels we couldn't spend a night, we had to sleep in our cars. This was Black America making its case, and I got to say, watching this, I was proud to be an American, proud to be a Black American that day.
Clarence Page, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Clarence Page is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and a syndicated columnist for the Chicago Tribune. There are photographs, remembrances, and the contents of the official program of the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom on our website at www.npr.org. The event ended with this rendition of a very famous song. In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.